If you're a fan of the Security Ledger podcast and listen to us on Apple's iTunes, take a moment to rate our podcast and maybe even leave a review. iTunes listener ratings and reviews help boost our visibility within the app and make it easier for others to find the Security Ledger podcast. So help us out by rating us. Hello and welcome to the Security Ledger podcast. I'm Paul Roberts, the editor-in-chief at the Security Ledger. In this week's podcast, October is just around the corner, and that means Cybersecurity Awareness Month is upon us. So what are the top cybersecurity professionals aware of these days? We talk with Justin Somaney, the Chief Security Officer at SAP, to find out. But first,
DHS is confirming the emergency broadcast system was hacked. And they're finding similarities between the way in which the tactics were used for that as also at the TV stations. So there's a linkage between those two. There's also social media campaigns popping up. There's another trending Twitter message is a photo of the logs of the emergency management system showing that the hack came from the Democratic Party headquarters in the city.
It's a bad election day in Norlandia, the fictional city in an unnamed swing state. A shadowy hacking group calling itself the Broken Eagle Task Force, or BETF, is protesting the global order and is looking to disrupt voting within the city's environs. That's the scenario of an exercise that took place in Boston last week. The Election Hacking Tabletop exercise, hosted by the firm Cyber Reason, pulled together officials from the city of Boston and other area cities, as well as law enforcement, to test out their response to an imagined cyber attack. Cyber Reason wanted to test how officials would react to election hacking by other means that don't even touch voting equipment, vote tabulation systems, or government networks. In our first segment, I was joined in the Security Ledger studios by Ross Rustici, the Senior Director of Intelligence Services at Cyber Reason, and Sam Curry, a Red Team member and the Chief Security and Product Officer at Cyber Reason. We talked about the goals of the election hacking exercise and also what surprising conclusions emerged from the event.
I'm Ross Rustici. I'm the Senior Director of Intelligence at Cyber Reason.
I'm Sam Curry. I'm Chief Security Officer for Cyber Reason.
Welcome both of you to Security Ledger Podcast.
Thanks for having us.
So this is a really fascinating exercise, tabletop exercise, election hacking focus that you did. It involved people both from the Boston Police Department, people who are involved in local government here in Boston, other cities like Lowell nearby, and obviously folks from the Cyber Reason team who had backgrounds more in sort of the information security, cyber defense world as well. A really fascinating exercise. I guess one of the big takeaways was this was an election hack that really did not involve targeting or compromise of election systems in any way, shape, or form. Talk about that.
We really wanted to explore the second order effects. If a hacking group wanted to affect the outcome of an election, undermine this voter confidence in the process itself, what other levers did they have available to them to do that? A lot of press and scrutiny has been given to the voter rolls and the voting machines really since 2016 as a result of what the Russians did. So we wanted to expand that scope and demonstrate that the threat landscape is actually much broader than those very specific vulnerabilities, and see how well the blue team, the local first responders, would be at dealing with the layered effects that hackers could do with the connected cities that are blossoming across the country.
Paul, it's worth noting, though, that on the red team, even though we couldn't attack them as an option, we did pretend to. We put out comms that said that we had in some districts in the final move,
right?
Because we didn't want to create havoc. So hopefully that was something the blue team didn't expect.
That's Sam Curry speaking. And Sam, you were a key member of the red team. This was a hacking group called Broken Eagle Task Force, or BETF. Talk a little bit about Broken Eagle, Sam. Who was this group?
Oh, yeah. Down with the system. Down with the man. We represented, I suppose, an extreme perspective that was unhappy with the way that a diverse pluralistic society was giving voices to minorities and really wanted to revamp the system, the manifesto. And so what we wanted to do was discredit the system, right? We didn't want to stop the elections. We just wanted to create chaos and debate and doubt in the system that would persist for months and years. So that actually informed some of the decisions we made, where I think we could have had, there was an interesting exchange at one point where we wanted to try to stop the elections altogether. We thought, hey, that would be havoc. And then we clued in that our job isn't to create chaos in the city, in this fictional city of Nolandia. Instead, it was to let them finish, but have the results be in question and to be undermining to people's faith in those who are elected in the system and the process itself.
This exercise took place in Boston, Massachusetts, but the city Nolandia, tell us a little bit about the city, the imaginary city that this tabletop exercise took place in.
I very much didn't want the locality to influence the way in which people played. Given the fact that we had Boston PD represented, given the fact mm-hmm. that a lot of participants lived in and around Boston proper, I didn't want them to be hyper-focused on the realist aspects of, well, the T operates in this manner, so you couldn't possibly do that. Or I know the Zagum Bridge gets backed up at this time, so it'd be a great target. So we pulled a city map from across the world. It was actually Sydney's city map. And we created some arbitrary districts. And we fed political information to the red team. The blue team didn't have that to create some asymmetry and knowledge of how to plan out the attacks from the red's perspective. And the goal was to really give a clean slate. So it was about the process of responding rather than specific details of how they would respond in a very specific case given geography. We wanted the takeaways to be about process and preparedness, not headlines about vulnerabilities in the city of Boston or a particular police department. I mean, that's the other reason why we chose to go with a hacktivist group that kind of had a anarchist type mantra rather than modeling them after a specific nation state actor. Because we didn't want people to hone in on, oh, it's a nation state attack. It's Russia, it's China, it's whomever. We wanted them to think about the fact that everything that Red Team executed are things that are in the wild that have already been used. They haven't been stacked together the way the Red Team's done it, but it's well within the realm of possibility that a hacker would do this, and it wouldn't even necessarily be that difficult given the tools that are floating around out there already. And that's the takeaway that we're really trying to strive towards.
And I was an observer at this tabletop exercise. One of the things that really struck me was that the Red Team was looking at this city, Nolandia, very much in terms of its political makeup. In other words, what types of voters you had, red and blue designations,
and purple,
right? Yeah, red, blue, and purple that were used to kind of color different precincts or in the city. Whereas on the blue team side, the folks who were government officials, they simply had a map with the numbers of the precincts. There was no political information put into that, as you would expect for, you know, government officials, public employees, that they wouldn't necessarily be looking at their city in that way. But of course, this exercise posited an election, you know, with different voters of different persuasions going to the polls. Talk about that decision as well.
The assumption going in was that when you're dealing with local first responders, particularly the police departments, the politics don't matter and they shouldn't matter. Their job is to protect the entire city from harm. And so that's what they focused on throughout the game. And we even did a couple game injects trying to influence the politics and amplify some of the messages that Red was putting out. And the response from Blue Team was categorically, we don't care. That's relevant information to it. And I think that's fairly true to form. And it's an interesting outcome of the game that while they're trying to make sure that people have the ability to vote, that they trust that the system isn't being rigged from a physical standpoint, they had no concern about how the election was actually taking place and who was eventually going to win it.
I saw that as well, and it was both encouraging. It was actually deeply touching in a way that these were public servants just kind of doing the job in front of them, and that there wasn't really a political consideration about, like, oh, we gotta, if it's happening in this precinct, we gotta take care of it because that's, you know, one of our precincts or something like that. You know, I mean, the focus was really on public safety, but the political dimension, even though the Red Team was completely influenced by politics because they were trying to affect the outcome of the election, the Blue Team was completely oblivious to the political dimension, except insofar as they started to realize that the goal was to disrupt the election. And you could kind of see that dawn on them through the various rounds of this game.
Yeah, I don't know if Sam wants to chime in from the Reds' perspective of how they dealt with the politics a bit, but the way the Blue Team played it, yeah, I would agree, it was very heartening, especially given the politics of the country right now, of how agnostic they were towards everything and how much they focused on simply triaging the physical events.
Yeah, on the red team, I have to say we were very politically motivated. We at one point even considered going after them personally. And what I mean by that is we were trying to associate the party color blue and unions and go after the police union and try to bias it that way.
Mm-hmm.
We opted not to go that path just because of how many resources we had available every turn. And we also developed some resources we never used. We actually created two hashtags and put out two opposing political perspectives. One was hashtag vote Nolandia, and it was seemingly trying to preserve the integrity of the vote, but actually doing things that were hurting it. And another one was a hashtag that was more extreme and about unfairness. We were trying to bring the validity of election results into question as well. So we were playing a lot of games at once. And as Ross said, it was all political. I, not seeing the blue room, was very surprised to hear afterwards that it took a while for them to realize it was political motivation.
Yeah, I mean, I was sitting in the red room as you guys kind of came up with the idea of the false gas leak. And that's something that has a lot of resonance here in the Boston area, because we had a major gas leak, you know, north of the city that caused a tremendous amount of damage.
I was actually personally affected by that. And I was wondering at the moment, at that time, I was saying, is it too soon? And we were like, nah, let's use it. It's fresh in everyone's mind. So we actually put out a false alert that there was a gas leak in it. And Ross had set it up very well. There were different events in different parts of the city. Some had car crashes, some had murders happening that day. But the place we said it was happening was where there was a political event. And that we then said there was an evacuation that had to take place. And we tried to call in bomb threats. And when we couldn't, we actually put out notification about bomb threats. So for us, it was all about really disrupting how people were getting to the polls and where.
It was really funny because you could see the red team concoct this idea like, oh, well, they'll have to evacuate the precinct. And I'm thinking, I don't know, you know. And then you go in the blue room and the report comes in from Russ about the gas leak. And they're like, well, we got to evacuate. Okay, well, they call that one right. I mean, the systems that you guys compromise in this quote unquote election hack, again, you were prohibited from attacking election systems, but the systems you did compromise were still pretty important. The emergency alert system, federal EAS system was one. The other was a denial of service attack against the 911 system. And then, as you mentioned, there was this connected smart traffic light network that you were able to hack. Talk maybe, Ross, about the role of these supporting systems, how they end up sort of inadvertently becoming part of this election security scenario as well.
Yeah. So, I mean, when you think about elections, it's a much broader ecosystem than the actual casting of the ballot itself. The ability of people to get to polls. And these are the things that you hear about every election when you talk about the dirty politics between parties and casting accusations about voter suppression, moving polling places so people can't get there, busing people to different precincts. These types of things are kind of always on the fringes of elections. And so what we thought through was, all right, this is in kind of the zeitgeist of elections. How would a nefarious actor pull all these threads together to have a concerted effect? Because one of these things happening is recoverable, but an organized, methodical campaign throughout the day, we were guessing would probably be overwhelming. And I think that's really what the outcome was, is that the blue team was capable of handling any one road bump, but they quickly ran out of resources and capacity to handle everything. And they got overwhelmed near the end in terms of what they were dealing with and where the next blow was going to come from. And so we wanted to choose the systems that, one, had proof of concept hacks out there already, so they were well within the realm of possibility for a group to compromise and execute on. Two, demonstrated some level of relevancy to the political process. And then three, I didn't want to constrain the red team too much, because there are a couple ways that I had gamed through the scenario and thought were likely paths, but I wanted to really allow the red team to have the creativity to pull on any lever they thought was relevant, as long as it was well within the bounds of reality.
I mean, one of the big challenges I saw the blue team deal with was just disinformation from, you know, the gas leak that ended up being a false alarm or you know, a bogus alert, the bomb threat, also, you know, a fake. And then, you know, the social media campaigns that this group was doing, also sowing disinformation, false information. Really difficult to struggle with that as your, first of all, because it's not technically your job responsibility as, like, say, the Boston Police Department, but obviously is a big part of people's perception of what is going on. So talk about disinformation as a tool that was used pretty heavily, I guess, Sam, by the Red Team.
Yeah, we look, there's a sort of hierarchy of or triage that all public servants and law enforcement and people who are first responders go through. You know, it's saving life, it's protecting infrastructure and the economy. And as citizens, we're all supposed to uphold the democracy, right? And the republic. So what we were doing was playing with that, with those priorities. To some extent, the job of a first responder, somebody who's interested in public safety, is an impossible task, right? There are going to be competing demands, and which one's most important, and which way do you break? And these are people who passionately want to do the right thing. Unfortunately, on the dark side, we get to pick our points of attack, and we get to throw out false alarms and diversions. We started the day thinking, you know, if I were to prioritize, there's a sort of four phases, right? There was this strategy phase where we took a couple of simple actions, but then there's really three phases to the day. It was 6 to 10 a.m., 10 to 2, and 2 to 6 p.m. So three phases for 12 hours. And we thought, all right, the biggie for us will be the end of the day, because after that, they can't fix it. So we want to create some pressure in the morning when people might be voting before they go to work. That's going to squeeze the rest of the day. And then when we hit them hard, at, you know, in the final 2 to 6 phase, that's when we're going to create the most havoc. And for us, it was a, you know, how do we get, to begin with, the first responders going to the wrong place and create havoc in a few districts that just have matching color. So by the end of the day, we were thinking about, we actually had developed a better understanding for the colors of these parties, and events had unfolded. We were down to political machinations. We wanted to make it seem like the governor was biased. We wanted the elections to complete, but we wanted them to complete in a way that would just you know, just diss the republic, right, or diss the system.
Yeah.
And so we used, you know, it's funny, we used all of our information resources early on, and we actually made a mistake. We didn't develop a new resource for the 10 to 2 timeframe, so we kind of got squeezed in terms of choices. But in that very first phase, we used both the early warning, the emergency warning system, and taking control of the television networks to send out official seeming messages about disasters. We wound up actually using a different mechanism in the middle of the day to send, because we couldn't call in a bomb threat. We hadn't developed that on one of the major arteries, a bridge joining the north and south sides of the city. We wound up pretending that one existed by using social media for that. And at the end of the day, we had developed 2 million, you know, social media accounts as a botnet that we were able to use to send out all of our hashtag information I mentioned earlier as well. But information was far more effective in many cases than what we were able to do with the physical infrastructure. And aside from the botnet, there wasn't that much that was uniquely cyber. For all that it actually perfectly mirrors cyber conflict, we were able to, I felt we walked away. I thought we'd won, but to be honest, it's asymmetric in terms of victory anyway, right? I think the blue team did a great job, but it was a fun exercise, but information warfare was the name of the game.
One of the things that struck me is that I'm not even sure by the end of the exercise that the folks there who are public safety officers, public, were overly focused on political dimensions and the narrative that was developing out of the incident. I think they looked at it more as like, you know, there are no dead people. And so this was a good day. You know, nobody died. Everybody, you know, we'll get back to normal with these systems, but everybody's safe. You know, elections, it strikes me, are you know, they're political, and the political system is basically in charge of running them and ensuring their validity. You know, the Secretary of State's office, for example. I'm just wondering, I guess, is the lesson that maybe those offices need more tools or more levers to pull themselves when confronted with a concerted effort to disrupt or influence an election, whether that's extending voting out for a number of days, you know, so there's no longer this, you know, 16-hour window of voting.
One of the things the blue team did repeatedly when it was communicating with Whitesell was essentially punt to the Secretary of State's office. So anything that was political or anything that had to do with the actual administration of the vote and the election itself, they essentially sent a question off or a demand that the Secretary of State and or Governor's office deal with it, which I think mimics real life to a certain degree, but it also demonstrates a gap in the communication pattern because the Secretary of State isn't going to understand what's actually happening on the ground in the same way that the cops do. And making sure that there is clear lines of communication there, even though they have very different goals in mind as they have that conversation, is incredibly important as far as making sure that you don't have something undermine the validity of the vote.
I mean, just by example, at one point they're talking about evacuating an entire precinct and just sending their voters to a different precinct to vote on election day. And you're sort of like, well, hold on. You know, you can't just do that.
On the red team, and I feel like a bad citizen here, we didn't actually know early on that voters could be moved to a different district. And we thought that that was a no-no. Like, we didn't understand that if the voter rolls just could make it to the new district or to other city voting polling places, that voters could move. And so we actually tried in our early moves to, we thought that was a no-no. We tried to send that message out using official mechanisms and say, hey, voting is closed in these two districts, go to anywhere else in the city to vote. And actually Whitesell wound up altering that message, which was really fascinating. And I believe Ross actually spoke to actual state officials about how they would handle, you know, having to move voters, and it was a simple answer. Knowing now what I know, I would actually, and that bridge that Ross mentioned between you know, what the police said was go to the Secretary of State every time, I would actually develop early in the game trying to own the identity or the office of the Secretary of State in order to affect that bridge. I didn't know that going in. So as a red teamer, I discovered something about the political process and about how our democracy works. But I would use that next time around.
It was an incredibly interesting event from my perspective, being able to kind of sit in and watch the thought process on both sides. And despite the fact that it was a tabletop where you're just essentially passing paper back and forth, it was alarmingly realistic in the way that it played out. And the blue team, I think, performed better than I was necessarily expecting, and that is heartening. But there's still a large gap that needs to be filled. And I hope that the members of the blue cell take that lesson back and start planning for some of these eventualities, because the way in which this election was manipulated is more of a matter of if than when.
I agree with what Ross said at the end about, you know, winning and losing and what happened over time. But I have to represent and say, red team, we rocked it. and on top of that, I will say that, you know, our democracy is a precious thing. And these types of events, I think, are really important, not just for those who are there, but the takeaways about looking at a broader picture and thinking ahead of time. Ross, excellent point about knowing who to call and what to do in a crisis, but also thinking the next time it comes, having people be able to say is, you know, yes, by all means, save lives and protect infrastructure and so on, but also being aware there could be a political dimension the next time around and being able to make that call to the resources a little bit sooner for folks. I think Boston is in great shape, but I don't think all cities everywhere are. And this is everybody out there who's in the U.S. or in other democracies, it's important for us to protect it. So I hope the lessons carry further and we can run these things again.
Ross Rushchichi and Sam Curry of Cyber Reason, thank you so much for coming on and speaking to us on the Security Ledger.
And thanks for having us.
Sam Curry is the Chief Product and Security Officer at Cyber Reason. Ross Rustici is the Senior Director of Intelligence Services at CyberReason. Up next, October is Cybersecurity Awareness Month. For consumers, that means maybe boning up on your account security or getting yourself a password manager. But what if you're the Chief Security Officer of a $128 billion global corporation? In our second segment of this week's Security Ledger podcast, we sat down with Justin Somany, the Chief Security Officer at the firm SAP. Somany has the distinction of being the first CSO at Yahoo and also at the firm Symantec. In this conversation, we talk about how even sophisticated technology firms can lose their way on security and about the challenge of being the first security officer on the ground inside a large and sophisticated global technology operation.
Justin Somany, Chief Security Officer for SAP.
Justin, welcome to the Security Ledger podcast.
Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you. So we're talking, it's almost October, and of course, October is Cybersecurity Awareness Month. So it's a treat to have somebody of your stature. So you're in a great position to talk about, as we head into Cyber Awareness Month, what are you aware of and what's top of mind for you and I guess by extension for SAP?
Yeah, no, thanks. I think when we think about security today versus 20 some odd years ago when I started, there's no question that it's advanced, not only at the threat level, but also our maturity on the defense side quite a bit. Yet we still struggle with some challenges, not only education and culture change within our organizations, how we manage a complete supply chain, regardless of what kind of product and service that a company delivers. But probably more importantly than that is how do we stay on top of the management of technology and remediation of vulnerabilities and the monitoring of our environments to identify and defend against attacks. More prominently in that is the large scale and volume of devices and systems as well as people that create content. Monitoring that is a dramatic challenge. And so driving awareness to those employees and operations teams and partners helps out with that. But really, how do we implement a significant infrastructure to be able to do that at scale seamlessly and not miss that one small attack that slips through the cracks on a daily basis?
Yeah, I mean, we've all seen examples of that in the headlines, right? This innocuous phishing attack that ends up becoming a months-long intrusion and everything that follows from that.
Absolutely.
So SAP, I mean, you guys are really the brains of many sophisticated global Fortune 500, Fortune 50, Fortune 10 firms. Is the CSO role that you hold a new one to SAP? And what is your charge there? And what are your top priorities within SAP?
As the Chief Security Officer, I'm accountable for probably three main domains or core domains. Physical security, which includes traveler safety, et cetera, for the 95,000 employees and other 50,000 contractors that we have around the globe in 200 countries. The second major domain is enterprise security, which is the infrastructure, networks, workstation servers, cloud environments that you would expect. And then product security, which is all the code that we create, making sure it's not only vulnerability-free, but also that we're working on advanced capabilities inside of our products, whether it's cloud or on-premise, to defend against the attacks that we see and our customers see. While security has been around at SAP well before I came on board, I started in the December of 2015 as the first head of security in these domains, the first CSO to really drive security for our customers and our employee base to where we all want it to be to defend against these attacks that you would expect.
I think people often assume that large and sophisticated technology companies are, of course, going to have their house in order when it comes to the security of their own network, you know, employees who use their corporate systems, business partners, and so on. But you know, obviously history shows that that's obviously and often not the case. You've done this for a number of companies. You were a CISO at Symantec as well, if you go back a few years, without speaking specifically about any of the companies you work for. Is it the case that sophisticated technology companies that are, you know, making sophisticated technology products often fall into the same traps as less sophisticated companies or organizations out there when it comes to their own security?
Yeah, I think across the industry, we suffer challenges at various stages and size of companies. And so it runs the gamut. Whether you're a small company, you have specific challenges of being able to staff or security expertise. At a larger company, you obviously have that capacity. But the challenge of breadth and scope across your network, there's merger and acquisition. So you're constantly bringing in companies that are much smaller and probably are not up to the same level of security implementation that the larger company has. Mm-hmm. You also have, you know, innovative, you know, ideas that are being done as a proof of concept that need to run fast and agile, that you need to manage from a risk management level. So it does run the gamut from predictive and managed risk to merger and acquisitions, which, you know, kind of build out. And then, of course, as a large company with a large customer base of 350,000 of the largest governments and companies around the globe, you constantly deal with the advanced attacks that are going against our customers, but land on our shoulders because we're hosting their data and content. And so that transformation on the threat side constantly means that we need to adapt and evolve on the defense side as well.
There's a lot of talk these days about, you know, software supply chain security and how important it is, also how difficult it is. I look at SAP, very large organization, huge code base. I don't even want to know how big it is, but also tons of legacy code, and I'm guessing tons of different dependencies. How do you handle that? And what systems, processes are you guys putting in place to address both the legacy code that you need to keep secure and this push into the cloud and everything goes along with that?
Honestly, when I came into SAP, product security was probably one of the oldest, one of the most heavily invested, but as well as most mature product security team I've seen in industry. So came into a very envious and enviable position because of that. And what that product security team is doing is leveraging the very mature and consistent practices across a company around software development. And so we're able to stand on the shoulders of what the CTOs and development teams have done on standardizing on internal code libraries, standardizing on the development process, which is critical for us to be able to inject security into that. And so we have tools that we push out, but they all the development releases are commonly managed into central tools and repositories, which allow us to hook in to get that scalability and consistency and those processes all the way down into the agile scrum teams for remediation are well instantiated and documented. So it's actually quite impressive, quite honestly. And I say that not because I built it, but walked into it. Of what they've been able to do and accomplish. But of course, you brought up open source. The supply chain of open source is uniquely challenging, as that is very significant with multiple parties that are outside of your organization. So any company struggles with the challenge of, if we find a vulnerability in open source that is not addressed in that open source community, do we fix it and fork the code? Obviously, we submit it back to the community, but how do you manage that? And we've been working through that for years now with quite a significant amount of success. But it's a significant challenge as we see the threat actors really exploiting that general weakness in the consumption of open source. And we expect it to increase.
You were at Yahoo as the CISO at a very interesting time. It was before what we now know of the breaches that were disclosed in 2016, but happened earlier. It was kind of before that, but just before it. And then you moved on, I think, to Box and other companies after that. I'd be really interested to know or hear what you remember from your time at Yahoo and what you learned from your time there, if you were surprised subsequently by the depth of the security issues that ended up taking place there.
Yeah, I think every company has strengths and weaknesses around every function, and security is no different. And one of the reasons why I go to companies is for, you know, challenges and to address and fix problems. And not unlike SAP, I was the first CISO at Yahoo. So there was a lot of really talented, skilled individuals. But there's no question, as we face across the industry, patch management, configuration management, no company is left not suffering from those challenges. And so I think the lessons that I take from all the companies and driving into the common areas of focus, the common areas of advantage that we have are pretty consistent around, you know, how do we just get a really good operational model in the company around IT and IT management? How do you get a really good and mature code development process in the company, especially if you're producing software, services, and products? And more importantly, is driving a culture of security, really getting a open dialogue with employees, an open dialogue with management to make sure that they're aware of the issues, whatever those issues might be. And they're part of the solution instead of being part of the inherent problem by not being informed and not taking action unto themselves. And so those common, you know, traits are transcend across every company, as well as the entire industry globally that we face.
So you've been in this position of coming in and basically starting a CISO function from scratch. What are the biggest problems that you see companies have as you walk in the door as a first CISO?
Honestly, some of the biggest problems are so basic: managing money on any CapEx and OpEx maturity for an organization. How do you make sure your budgets are tight? How do you make sure your staff are properly reviewed, skilled, trained, educated, supported in a lot of ways for the jobs that they're done? How do you make sure that you have a good communications program for, you know, executive management and for general use awareness programs? But also, how are you making sure that you're involved in the weekly or monthly staff meetings of key leaders in the company to listen, to understand? And probably lastly, one of the most significant things that I think every CISO needs to do, and I've talked about this in the past, is learn the business. Every company has a unique culture, and you need to understand that if you're going to drive security into that culture. So participating in the marketing organizations, the sales organizations, the product development organizations, building a relationship with those leaders to understand what motivates them so you can speak the same language instead of expecting them to understand yours. And so those are generally the common challenges that you need to come in and figure out first. After that, then we can roll in security into those, you know, organizational leaders, the company as a whole, and the product processes that everybody depends upon.
Okay, so we're coming into October, Cybersecurity Awareness Month. If you're speaking out there to the, you know, security ledger audience, which is not just Fortune 500 companies, a lot of folks who work at smaller organizations, maybe even individuals, what's your advice? What would you recommend for them as an organization to become more cybersecurity aware?
I think first, for any security leader or practitioner, be self-critical. I think we have a tendency to project onto others instead of first being critical about ourselves. How are we, you know, learning, growing as a discipline in our industry and maturing it? How are we understanding the organization which we're operating to work within those borders for whatever we need? And then second, you know, be very empathetic, be very transparent with those organizations in order to get security change that is needed for all of us. Beyond that, you know, of course, everybody talks about the threat landscape, which I usually stay away from. But I do think that there are some really interesting gaps that we have. It would be remiss for me at SAP not to speak about where we generally see security at a technical level within our operating systems, our networks, et cetera. But we really need to evolve and mature in identifying and solving the security challenges in the business processes of our companies, whether that's, you know, hire to retire and workforce management, quote to cash and procurement and processing, the marketing cycles. That is exactly where the threats are coming, are going to their destination, to either wire out funds or gain intellectual property. If we don't understand those business processes and then work with those business partners to harden the process, put in technical or process controls to identify and defend against those attacks, we're still going to be playing whack-a-mole a little bit down lower in the stack on network and workstation level issues, which are important. But it's just not the complete picture that we need to work for.
Right. I mean, we see that broadly with phishing, and then more specifically with things like, you know, business email compromise, right? Which is, you know, not a technical attack. Right. It's a social engineering attack and a business process attack.
That's absolutely right. And I think that's a perfect example about every security team should reach out to their finance department and understand what are the analytics that we put in for fraud. For the creation of a new vendor where money is going to be wired out at a certain level. And so it's that combination of business problem driving in technical and process solutions, and business compromise is exactly a perfect example.
Final question. You were first CISO at Yahoo, first CISO at Symantec. How do you see the role changing? I mean, I think the idea initially was this is the voice of security to the C-level, to the board. Is that still the primary function, or how do you see the role evolving?
Yeah, I definitely. Other than I have got grayer hair, I think the audience is a little bit more refined in our minds. And so, of course, we have all employees that we need to communicate out to. That's a massive audience. The line managers is a massive audience. Of course, the business unit leaders as well, whether it's the board, executive board members, or presidents of organizations or lines of businesses, is a significant and critical audience for us to partner up with, communicate to, educate, and really empower and drive them to enforce security within their domains. But it's not just limited within our boundaries. Because we're, you know, we've got cloud services that everybody's consuming, multi-cloud, a complete supply chain, you now need to expand that out into your suppliers, your contractors, your customers, and educate them to a great degree on their security visibility on whatever product and service that they're consuming on your from you, but as well as government affairs, you know, teams, and having a voice in public policy as international laws, jurisdictional laws with GDPR, China security laws, India's coming out with theirs, Russian laws, as well as U.S. We've got a significant jurisdictional effect that's taking place. And so for us as a practitioner to partner up with our government affairs teams, to have a voice of the practitioner to those venues on what is actually helping solve security problems versus creating more challenges for us, I think is important as well.
Justin Somaini, Chief Security Officer at SAP, thank you so much for coming on and speaking to us on the Security Ledger podcast.
Thank you.
Justin Somaini is the Chief Security Officer at SAP. He was here talking about Cybersecurity Awareness Month, which starts October 1st.